ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Two police officers are dead and a third is seriously injured after a dramatic execution-style ambush during a house call in Victoria.
I'm Damien Carrick. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National Summer, leading the national conversation of legal stories and cases.
Victoria Police has widened the search for accused killer Desi Freeman.
A 56-year-old local who is heavily armed is still at large.
What I would say to the community and say to anyone who may be considering or harbouring or supporting him, they need to reconsider. They're committing a criminal offence and we will prosecute them.
This year saw a massive manhunt for alleged police shooter Desi Freeman in Victoria's mountainous northeast. The 56-year-old is accused of killing two police officers and seriously injuring a third on a property near the town of Porepunkah last August. In the past, Freeman had been linked to the so-called Sovereign Citizens Movement.
That was my 15th hearing, by the way, in 2.5 years. The court is totally corrupt and lawless. They're unable to obey a single law.
Professor David Heilpern is Dean of Law at Southern Cross University and before that worked as a magistrate for 22 years. As a judicial officer, David had many sovereign citizens appear before him in court, and now as an academic researches this area. I spoke to David in September. David, good to talk to you again. What do we know about the attack which took place in the town of Porepunkah, which is near Mount Buffalo in Victoria's northeast?
Well, we know that 10 police attended at the premises. We know that they were there to execute a search warrant. And we know that the police knew that the person of interest had previously had negative interactions with the police and the courts. The allegation is that when the police knocked on the door, he shot two of the police officers. They died, and a further police officer was shot and was injured.
And what do we know about this suspect, Desi Freeman?
Well, we know that he's had some interaction with the courts before and that he identifies as a sovereign citizen. Typically, his initial interaction seems to have been through traffic law.
And let's come back to traffic law a little bit later. I believe there had been, he had gun licenses taken from him previously.
Indeed, his gun licenses had been revoked and his guns had been seized because of his negative interaction with the criminal justice system previously. And that's a little bit cloudy. We don't quite know what offences that was for, but certainly it would appear that, the allegation is that he had manufactured firearms that were used on the police.
And late last year, there's a decision of the Supreme Court of Victoria involving Desi Freeman and a number of driving offences. What do we know about that?
Well, we have a written report of that case, of that judgment. And look, it's got a lot of information in it that no doubt the authorities are going through, and it's worth reflecting on some of the matters that are raised in it. We know that he started in the local court charged with three traffic offences: speeding, using his mobile phone, and refusing to take a drug detection test. We know that he lost in the local court. He appealed to the county court in Victoria. There, he won the speeding appeal, but lost the other two matters, and then he went to the Supreme Court on a questions of law.
And there's a lot of information in that judgment about how he describes police officers. Can you tell me what he says?
Well, he obviously has great disdain for police officers. And one of his grounds of defence is self-defence, which he says is triggered by the fact that he was defending himself because he's been abused by Nazi thugs, police officers previously.
I think at some point he says, leave me alone, you terrorist, out here with guns terrorising kids again. I've been to court 15 times because of you corrupt scum, you corrupt filth. That's just one of the quotes from his interactions with police, which is set out in the judgment. Anything else strike you from those interactions as recorded in the judgment?
Absolutely. This is textbook sovereign citizen material. And if you look at the websites that promote this sort of material and charge people for it and have subscribers, then the arguments that he raises in at all levels, at the local court, the county court and the Supreme Court, is classic sovereign citizen language and classic sovereign citizen so-called legal argument. But it's worth keeping in mind that the matter in the Supreme Court and the judgment is on a preliminary application by the prosecution for summary judgment. In other words, they're arguing that there is no arguable basis. The matter never gets to evidence, it never gets to full hearing, because the prosecution succeeds in having it thrown out on that very high hurdle initially.
So he was unsuccessful there. So Desi Freeman apparently changed his name from Desi Philby. What does that suggest to you?
This is a common feature of sovereign citizens, especially at the hard, more fanatical end, is that they change their name, and it's almost always to free man. They think that this gives them some immunity or some separation from the legal system by their declaration of freedom from the delusion of some sort of freedom from the rest of the criminal justice or legal system.
David, what exactly are sovereign citizens and what is pseudo-law?
Look, I prefer to use the term sovereign citizen because it's the common one, and I know that there's an academic attraction to the term pseudo-law, but essentially they're one and the same. Sovereign citizens are a grab bag of various ideologies. There's Christian sovereign citizens, there is right-wing sovereign citizens, there's New Age sovereign citizens, but the commonality is a belief that the justice system and the legal system does not apply to them, that they can opt out, that they can not consent to the laws, either by contract or by corporate law or by capitalising their name, changing their name, entering into agreements with each other or even with themselves to separate themselves from the legal system. And that's the commonality.
And what was the argument of Desi Freeman in the Supreme Court? Was he running sovereign citizen ideas or sovereign citizen arguments?
Many of them. He was arguing, for example, that there's a constitutional bar to the Roads Act applying at all throughout the whole state of Victoria because it's a Commonwealth power. He was arguing that he has bodily sovereignty and bodily autonomy and therefore can't be legally asked to take a test. He was arguing that the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights protects him from the laws of Victoria with respect to roads. All of this grab bag of arguments that this law does not apply to me.
You're listening to The Law Report, available as a podcast via the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Today we're talking about sovereign citizens. I'm speaking with Professor David Halpern. He's currently Dean of Law at Southern Cross University, and before that he worked as a magistrate for over two decades. Moving away from Desi Freeman, you worked as a magistrate for 22 years. What was your experience of sovereign citizens when they appeared before you in court? Can you describe some of those experiences for me?
Yes. Look, at first it was patchy. There weren't many sovereign citizens. I first sat in the west of New South Wales, and there was maybe one or two a year who would come running these sort of sovereign citizen arguments. They'd refuse to acknowledge their own name. They'd insist it be capitalised. They would say they were travellers, not drivers. It was almost always traffic offences. But over the years, these numbers increased and increased rapidly in the lead up to COVID and, of course, post-COVID, even more so. But the arguments not only became more common, they also became more vociferous and difficult. As you'd know, the local court's a very busy place, and if you've got 80 matters in a list and you've got two or three sovereign citizens that are going to take up half an hour or an hour if they challenge you because they think they've got a right to a jury or because you weren't sworn in properly because you didn't use the right oath words or because the Queen is not recognised properly in the Royal Coat of Arms, then these matters take considerably longer. And that's the main pressure in the local court, is just to try and cope with dealing with these matters.
And how would you deal with these matters? I mean, would you try to explain to these people that there was no solid legal basis for what they were putting forward? Or would you just sort of say, no, look, I'm sorry, I've got to get on to the next case here?
They're always self-represented, and we know why that is. From a legal point of view, legal practitioners can't put legal matters before a court or argue for them if they know that they are utter garbage. So lawyers will refuse to act for them. And of course, we all know also that self-represented people have a right not to be treated with kid gloves, but to certainly be heard and to have any issues that they put refuted. So it's difficult to draw a line. And sometimes we can see in Queensland there's authorities where people have said, well, if you're not this person, I'll just deal with it summarily. And the Supreme Court has said, no, you've got to delve a little bit deeper. If you really think this is the person, then you've got to try and discuss that with them and try and explain very carefully the outcomes if the person's not present. So really, it's a matter of a very fine line between undertaking your obligations as a judicial officer with an unrepresented person and your obligations to the administration of justice to ensure that things are moving right along. If there's time, I had some success by presenting articles and commentary and also just pointing out that nowhere ever in any Australian court have these arguments been accepted, that they're doomed to fail, and that the cost of progressing these arguments is that you lose a discount for any plea of guilty or admission, and that the consequences of ignoring court orders, like driving while you're disqualified or not complying with bail conditions, can lead to imprisonment.
Mm. So you can be far worse off if you run a sovereign citizen argument and strategy than if you engage with the legal system as it is designed to be engaged with.
And the High Court's decisions on sovereign citizen matters are littered with examples of where a speeding fine turns into costs of many hundreds of thousands of dollars, where a minor matter that leads to disqualification ends up with the person being imprisoned because they then drive while they're disqualified. And I think we've all seen the YouTube and TikTok videos where sovereign citizens are confronted by ever-patient police officers who then have to break their way into cars. We also have the examples of two sieges in New South Wales in 2023, both of whom were sovereign citizen adherents and both of whom were killed by police in sieges. So, you know, there's a pointy edge to this of non-compliance with legal requirements that is dangerous for both police and, of course, for sovereign citizen adherents.
We also have the Weambilla police shooting in southwest Queensland in December 2022. Two police officers and a neighbour were murdered. What do we know about those killings? Can they be described as sovereign citizen inspired?
Yes, they can be. The coronial inquest is yet to hand down its findings. However, what we do know is the very close relationship between the trains and Donald Day Jr. in America. Indeed, he's been arrested in the United States over his involvement. And he is a very hardcore absolutionist on the sovereign citizen sphere. And he was their principal advisor and influencer on all reports and submissions so far. Their particular position is clouded also by a fundamentalist Christianity that also impacted on their determination to comply with the law. But they certainly fit within the spectrum of sovereign citizens. And I think that immediately after that is when ASIO and the Australian Federal Police made it quite clear that they view sovereign citizens as a significant threat to public safety.
And we're talking there about Nathaniel Gareth and Tracy Train, two brothers and one of their wives who were responsible for the shooting at Weambilla in southwest Queensland in December 2022. And I guess we'll have to wait for the findings and the recommendations of the coronial inquest for the full picture of what happened. Can I ask you, David, bearing in mind that people with sovereign citizens' ideas can be very well-meaning people with very heartfelt beliefs at one end of the spectrum, did you ever actually feel threatened by some sovereign citizens when they appeared before you in court?
I think the point is very well made that it should be encouraged for people to challenge, question, dispute, and seek to change the law. That's part of a vibrant democracy. But at the hard edge, there is extreme danger. And yes, both myself and another magistrate and police were threatened and had security upgrades as a result. And indeed, there was a siege, there was an arrest, and that person is serving a lengthy time in custody. That wasn't the only threat, of course, that comes from sovereign citizens. I was sentenced to 5 years jail by a sovereign citizen court. It didn't seem to have much impact, but it is disarming, to say the least, to have those who are appearing before you believe that they have sentenced you and that therefore they have the power to arrest you. And indeed, in Desi Freeman's case, it's quite clear that he sought to arrest the magistrate who had first determined his matter and issued a warrant for the arrest of the then premier as well. So although we, part of my legal brain laughs at this, this is no laughing matter. There is a real edge to this. I suppose it comes down to this. If you don't believe authority against you is legitimate, in other words, if you don't believe the police knocking at your door or the courts before you determining your case are legitimate, then any action in resistance of that is self-defence. And that's indeed what Desi Freeman argued at all levels, that he was acting in self-defence because the actions against him were unauthorised and unlawful.
You're talking there about the Supreme Court matter, which we were talking about earlier, which was decided late last year. Now, David, you worked as a magistrate for many years and you're now an academic. And one of the areas of research that you focus on are sovereign citizens. And you recently were researching traffic offences and driving offences. How do you describe some of the people who provide information or advice on how to beat traffic fines in court, which you would say is based in the ideology of sovereign citizenship?
So I've subscribed to these websites and I've been to some of their workshops, in disguise, of course, to hear what they're advising people and telling people. And what is clear is that behind the sovereign citizen movement in terms of traffic matters in particular, but in a growing manner, the family law, is profit-making individuals who are selling legal gobbledygook by subscription and for profit. I am sure that they don't believe their own preachings, but what they do is they get people to subscribe, they promise that they will get them off their speeding fines or get their children back for them or the like, and of course they can't deliver. But these websites are, I find it staggering that they still exist. The authorities have not shut them down, and not because I don't believe in freedom of speech, but because if I sold shampoo and it made your hair fall out, I have no doubt that the authorities would come down and crack down on me hard, Consumer Affairs, ASIC, etc. Yet these websites are able to continue on a subscription and for-profit basis, encouraging people to subscribe, give over their money for an answer to their legal dilemma. That can never work.
And what sorts of advice do these websites and business models offer?
They suggest ways of blatantly misleading the courts to get delays. They suggest legal arguments that cannot work. They suggest technical arguments on issues like how radars work and the like that can never work. They claim that currency to pay fines is completely unenforceable. And they encourage effectively rebellion against the traffic law and indeed the criminal justice system itself. They spout common law, in inverted commas, that they say overrides the statutory provisions that people are in court for. They say that there are ways of getting out of paying your fines that are completely illegitimate and indeed unlawful. So that's the summary of their approach. And of course, the books that they produce and the manuals that they produce and the videos that you pay to watch are hundreds of pages in length and hours long. And if you can actually manage to see your way through it all, it's such a grab bag that it's very difficult to isolate it down to one issue. However, if you actually read the Supreme Court judgment that we were talking about before, most of those arguments in one way or another are raised in those cases and analysed and thrown out by the Supreme Court and the District Court before it.
David, what authorities or what regulators do you think should be stepping up and taking action against these for-profit organisations which spout sovereign citizen ideas?
Well, every state and territory and the Commonwealth has responsibility for consumer protection. And in the end, these are members of the public, some of them vulnerable, paying over hard-earned money to organisations that are making profit out of complete garbage and where their arguments can never succeed. So that is where I think we should start, in the standard consumer protection law arena of protecting consumers from rip-off merchants.
So the ACCC, Consumer Affairs, who are you thinking?
Well, some of the organisations are not incorporated. And so I think that that just about wipes out ACCC because they don't have the jurisdiction. But state-based organisations certainly do. So in New South Wales, Consumer Affairs Department has significant powers to shut down and close those organisations that are producing a product or a service that cannot possibly succeed.
I've spoken to a number of people about sovereign citizens in recent years. Your former colleague, New South Wales Magistrate Mark Douglas, and also researcher Harry Hobbs about issues around sovereign citizens. I understand that in the USA, the movement, the sovereign citizen movement, tends to be rooted in tax law. In Canada, it tends to be in family and constitutional law. And in Australia, it really does seem to be, at the moment, centred around driving offences. Is that your understanding as well?
I call it the gateway drug to sovereign citizenship in Australia. And yes, it is. And perhaps that's because we're such a big country. And indeed, there is one thing in the Supreme Court judgment that really stands out, and that is the appellant's absolute need for a driver's licence. One of the offences he was caught for was refusing to undergo a test under the drug detection laws because he said he's not a druggo and he didn't want to give up his DNA and things like that. The minimum mandatory penalty for that offence is 2 years disqualification. And he was arguing the crippling nature of that on someone who lives in a rural and regional area, someone with a family, and etc. Now, leaving aside those issues, you can see that he follows the classic path that almost every sovereign citizen I've encountered does, and that is they start with traffic law and they move on to the kind of broader level of separation from the justice system that sovereign citizenship encourages.
You talk about driving offences being the gateway drug. How significant was COVID in accelerating the growth of sovereign citizen ideas?
Well, there is universal acceptance that it led to an explosion. And the reason for that is not hard to understand. I think we saw infringements on our liberties that we've never seen before in our society. And for those who were affronted by that to a significant degree, they sought answers. So I think it's the first time, certainly in my lifetime, where we had to wear masks, where there were lockdowns, where vaccination was an absolute a predeterminer of a whole range of activities that we would otherwise be able to engage in. So those people who were affronted by this were also very attracted to the sovereign citizen movement, who exploited that and openly exploited that on all of their websites and the like, and drew connections between organisations that were anti-vax and anti-lockdown. And some of those organisations have indeed completely joined now in a post-COVID world.
I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report today, looking at sovereign citizens. And I'm speaking with Professor David Heilpern. He's Dean of Law at Southern Cross University and before that worked as a magistrate for 22 years. David, over the weekend we saw anti-immigration rallies around Australia, the March for Australia protests. How do you reflect on those protests and do you see any connections with the sovereign citizen movement?
Yes. Firstly, the sovereign citizen movement were promoting those marches ad nauseam. They claimed them as their own, as did many other organisations. But I think we also saw some of the banners, some of the pictures that have been televised and reported on of these marches that show a lot of sovereign citizen logos and paraphernalia.
What sorts of logos and paraphernalia did you see?
I do not consent. That is an absolute classic sovereign citizen statement that every single judicial officer and lawyer who's seen them in court will recognise as a badge. I think also in Adelaide, the horrific vision of photographs or placards depicting Desi Freeman and saying "Free Man" with Australian logo as well. I mean, I found that staggering, but is evidence also of a connection between, by idolising him, of sovereign citizenship and those marches.
David, what is the best way to counter sovereign citizen ideas, do you think?
I think two things. Firstly, I've already pointed out that these websites that are profiteering from it, they are unlawful. And I'm staggered that there's been no action taken. But that's not just my view. That's a view of other academics working in this field. And we've been calling for that for a long time. Secondly, I think that the strongest argument against it is simply pointing out that whatever your beliefs, you need to understand that this is never going to work in any court. Because if it is a hopeless cause, you know, I suppose it's like the earth is flat. Well, you can believe that, that's fine. It doesn't actually do any harm. But it's encouraging people to accept that whatever their beliefs, that the legal system will predominate in the end and that they will lose. So I guess that that's the best argument. I certainly have had some success in talking to people and pointing things out to them and explaining slowly. But when you're dealing with a cult and it becomes part of their identity and they have a financial connection by these ongoing subscriptions to the websites, it's difficult. But we need to actually have people trained, encouraging, educating those people who are dabbling or those people who are starting to delve to not go too far down the rabbit hole.
Who could do that work? Who could do that engagement?
Well, I think that the courts have a role to intervene. I mean, they do intervene and refer people for things like anger management, for drug rehabilitation, for behaviour change programs. So I think that we've got a model there and that we could start to look at. I don't think anywhere is doing it in the world, but why not? When people are having intervention in the courts and they're expressing these views, have officers who are well trained in this to be able to sit down and have a talk to these people. It takes time. Some you'll succeed with, some you won't. But one thing is really clear. Police and other enforcement agencies in our country cannot be permanently safe from extremists in the sovereign citizen camp. Two reasons for that. One, because there is a lot of them. And two, because you never know when you're going to have interaction with them. So I don't think that we can law enforcement our way out of this ideology. It's the best protection for police in these circumstances is prevention. I think there's also grounds for really good intelligence. I mean, obviously they had intelligence on Desi Freeman, but in the case of the trains in Queensland, there was much less intelligence for the officers going into it. So there's a range of approaches, and I guess we're going to have to trial them, see how they work.
Professor David Heilpern, Dean of Law at Southern Cross University, and before that, a magistrate in the courts for 22 years. Thank you for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you, Damien.
That's The Law Report for this week. Do follow the program on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. To follow, all you need to do is click on the Heart button. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and also to audio producer Angie Grant. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more Law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.